Today's show is sponsored in part by Retronyms. Retronyms makes tools for music creators. Audiocopy is a free app for recording, editing, and sharing music. You can find loops and grooves in any style to fit your taste. Make music whenever, wherever. Tap your inspiration and remember to keep it fresh. To get Audiocopy for free, visit retronyms.com/pod. That's RetroNyms.com/pod.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Jules Coleman. Hi, Jules.
Hey.
How's it going?
Not too bad.
Good. So maybe you can start by telling us what Hassle does or is.
Yeah, sure. So Hassle, it's an online marketplace for local house cleaners. We're based here in London, and we've expanded in the last couple of years to a few of the European countries, including Ireland, France, and Germany. So at its core, we connect customers and local cleaners, but obviously the devil's always in the detail.
Sure. And my understanding is that this is kind of like the beachhead, and then from here will come world domination, connecting everyone to everyone else, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen a huge movement in the last couple of years about bringing services online, and we're really only at the forefront of that. I think the cleaning certainly is sort of like the mass market service that, you know, most people can identify with, but we're starting to see this kind of technology and business platform go into like lots of different industries, and we'd like to be part of that.
Yeah, why not? So what is your role at the company?
So I'm a chief product officer at the company. So I'm one of the founders. And back in the good old days, there were just the three of us. So myself, Alex, and Tom. And we did everything. Now, thankfully, we have a wider cast with us, and I focus on product.
Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to focus on product?
Yeah. So I guess for our side, you know, and it's a familiar challenge, I guess, for any startup, there's always limited resources. It doesn't matter what size you are. Resources are limited, whether that's, you know, development resources or even just the bandwidth to think about things. And for me, you know, being the chief product officer means how do we prioritize all of those things we want to do, put them into a sensible order and try and get like, you know, the most forward progress in the shortest amount of time. So, you know, for us, we run a Kanban process in the team. So it's about finding those stories, you know, working out what are the ones that are really going to make a difference, making sure that we know what the problem is that we're trying to solve, and then making sure the solution that comes out the, you know, other end really does address that problem.
It's an interesting how important prioritization is, particularly when your resources are constrained, which is kind of always, I think. I think no one feels like they have unlimited resources, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No. So my background before actually working in startup, I worked for much larger companies. So as a management consultant, working with Accenture and then PricewaterhouseCoopers and IBM. And I think in some ways that was great grounding because I saw these huge companies, you know, the clients that I was working with along with those consultancies. And even there, you have the concept of, you know, scarce resources. So of course, when you come down to a startup of three people, that's a real thing, but it never goes away. Just the expectation of what you can get through and produce increases. So that scarcity remains a challenge always.
Yeah. So are you still involved with like writing code or things like that? Or is it higher level than that?
No, I still do. One of the things we moved to a Kanban process actually just over a year ago now. We were kind of flirting around with different ways of running the product process. And we've landed on our version, at least, of Kanban. But one of the things that we, you know, liked about our former sprint way of working was that there was a life cycle. You know, you entered a sprint, you completed it. There was a sort of a ceremony, a ritual to the process. And we didn't want to lose all of that in the Kanban world. So one of the things that we have is that every third Monday, we have something that we call Feature Monday. We have a day where everyone on the product team, so designers, developers, work on the small little features that kind of tend to get lost in the bigger product process. And we kind of keep them all together. We give them a home, and that's Feature Monday. And on like a given day, we can usually ship about 25 little like things.
That's awesome.
So that tends to be the limit of my production code these days. But I do like to, you know, I like to get involved in that. And I think it's always good to, you know, stay close to the code base and understand what's happening. But I don't take on any like huge epics at this point in time. It just doesn't seem to really happen.
I love that you schedule in those little features because it's so satisfying to ship a bunch of things all at once like that. And just to like kind of sand down the rough edges.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we make like an email we send out to the team, we've got this like little bus where we like write the number of features we've done. So like there's, you know, the saying like, you know, you wait for a bus and 3 come along at once. So we have the same thing. You wait for a feature and then 25 come along at once. Nice. And, you know, it's one of those things. There's always this like inverse correlation, I guess, with the amount of time a feature takes and the happiness in the team. Like some of these things that we do that like takes 5 minutes of our time are the things the guys like give us like the most praise for.
So true.
And I think it's nice to give them a home, and then, but also, yeah, it's quite satisfying to have that day where you kind of clean house, you know, and clear off the decks of those little cards.
I like that a lot. I might steal that. So we, Chris and I, the people that, the two developers on Upcase, we tend to like fit those things in when we're burnt out on other things.
Yeah.
So we'll be working on like longer projects, and it's like 4 o'clock, and we're like, all right, I'm sick of working on this, and I just want to like get a win, and so we'll just peel something off and do that.
Exactly.
But the idea of having a home for all those to live and a time to tackle all of them sounds really satisfying.
Exactly. Like we certainly don't prohibit working on the smaller things in between. I think it's always good to keep your sanity, you know, and those little downtime bits. But yeah, it's nice. You know, we at the start, we were like, oh, we were afraid we might run out of these ideas after we did a couple of the days. That's never once happened. There's like a list longer than our arm.
And, of course. There's a million of those little ones.
Yeah. We have a contrasting day then. So the kind of the third Friday of the cycle, so we still kind of run on this sort of 3 week cycle, which is a hangover from when we used to do 3 week sprints, and we have what we call Kaizen Friday, which is sort of it's related to Feature Monday, but it's basically a day when all of the product team gets to work on whatever feature or process change that they would like, that they think kind of would make their own processes faster or productivity faster in the future. So that could be anything. It might be a feature that you like wanted to go back and look at, or it could be like, you know, updating a certain gem or whatever else. But it's just that one day every 3 weeks to kind of be a little bit more introspective about, you know, what would make the process faster. And we kind of think leaving those little bits of ritual or kind of ceremony into the cycle really helps in a kind of Kanban world, but just sort of like never-ending throughput.
And what I like about that, but this idea of these like scheduled days, is that it actually takes away some choice, which I think is actually really great. Like it's hard to sometimes get in and be like, what am I going to do today? And like it's easy if you have a chief product officer who's like, this is most important, go do this. But sometimes like the day just kind of like yawns in front of you and is intimidating, or it's hard to prioritize. And if you have this schedule, like, oh, it's that particular Friday where we're just going to grab these kind of things, it's easy for you to know what to do, and you can just start immediately.
Yeah, I think it's nice. And it just gives a sort of, it breaks up the, you know, the period as well. It gives us, you know, in between that kind of Feature Monday and Kaizen Friday, you know, there are 13 sort of working days of like, you know, feature build. But I think it's always nice to change pace a little bit and just, you know, have that sense of progress as we go along.
And that Kaizen is a Japanese term, right?
Yeah, I think it comes from Japanese manufacturing. It's like constantly looking at the process, you know, seeing how you could improve. So kind of looking inwardly at what could be done to reduce errors or friction in the process. So and I think it's a nice kind of philosophy to have when kind of looking at your own processes.
Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of growth recently in headcount. I think you went from 7 to 50 in about a year.
Yeah, I don't recommend that.
I'm curious what's been challenging with that. Everything, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole kind of DNA of the company changes in that process, you know, and in many ways for the better. You know, when we were, you know, 6-7 people, we were doing everything. Like myself and Tom, my technical co-founder, we used to work every second Saturday. We'd alternate Saturdays, and we were kind of both, you know, customer service / developer, because we hadn't built all of the features required. So there were still things that would happen in the course of a business day that required for me to like fire up a console. Those happened on a Saturday. So we'd have to alternate and do that. And, you know, you're also 24/7 on call, you know, like DevOps when things go down and all that stuff. But, you know, so adding people into the team has been brilliant. But of course, hiring is always hard, and kind of going from 7 to 50 in a short period of time, you know, is particularly challenging. Trying to maintain that culture, you know, as you do that and making sure you don't lose sight of who you are as a company. I hope we've succeeded on many levels, but it's been a very challenging period.
What is core to your culture?
I think one of the things that we've always been, really, really clear on is, and in the best way possible, we are not a team of rock stars by any stretch, and that's not to kind of talk down the skills and ability of our team, because they're fantastic guys. But I think it's more about what can a team like where there isn't a lot of ego and there isn't showmanship kind of actually achieve. Mm-hmm. And I think it's always surprising what you can achieve with that. So it's a very flat company. Myself and Tom, we have founder in our title or whatever, but that doesn't bestow upon us any magical powers. So mm-hmm. we're just kind of members of the team as well. And we think everyone has something to contribute to that, and that you actually get to some really great outcomes when you listen to what everybody has to offer and work on them. But it can be hard. It's very easy to build in bureaucracy into companies as they grow. We saw it happening. Absolutely. And you got to actually fight against that, assuming that's what you want. mm-hmm. But there's also a time and a place for some process. I think that was the kind of balancing act that we've had to kind of balance, is that when there was five of us and everyone knew everything intimately, it was fine that nothing was written down. But when you're mm-hmm. employee number 51 and you're not really sure who does what, or how does this part of the company work, or what's the policy here or there, actually having some things written down and being that little bit more formal is comforting to people. So it's trying to balance the free rein and but also not being incredibly bureaucratic as you grow.
Yeah. So if you had to leave the company and wanted it to continue on its path and be successful, what would you tell the people that were left behind you?
Wow.
Or your replacement?
I think, it sounds really cliched, but it's certainly in my role, like the users, whoever that might be, whatever the group is, the users tell you what the problems are. You just have to listen and do it. We've probably made our biggest mistakes when we've not listened to, the people that actually really do use our product, in anger. Just having that, again, lack of ego, I guess. It's not me trying to put through my features or whoever might come along. It's trying to make the product better so that, whoever has to use this, whether that's a customer or a cleaner or one of our customer service team or whoever that is, all you're trying to do is make their day a little bit better. We have the tools and the resources at our disposal to make that happen. You just need to listen to it and see what it is that is needed.
Is there a danger in that, letting your product be guided too much by your users? Can that happen?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, every product manager knows the symptom of, a single user asking for something and suddenly it being like a must-have priority, must skip to mm-hmm. the top of the list. Of course, there is, in product management, there is, it's in the title, there is a management there. And partly that's common sense and partly it's intuition on part of the product team to know really, what is required and what's just a, complete edge case that's being requested.
Yeah.
But, and I think it's also important, the product team to have an overall strategy or where they're trying to get to, or some of their own beliefs. But at the same time, you can be wrong sometimes in that and you're just pushing uphill. One of the very early things we did, we made a complete basic error, I guess, when we started out first. We assumed, okay, we're building technology here for cleaners, house cleaners. And we made the erroneous assumption that they would not have access to smartphones. In fairness to us, this was 3.5 years ago, 4 years ago. We started building all of this product based around SMS functionality. So they could interact with our product using SMS. And then they kept turning up to the office with better phones than I had. One of the learnings that we had was that actually they didn't tend to have a laptop at home with a broadband connection, but what they did have was a smartphone with a data plan. And so we've gone down this whole strategy of trying to build technology that was brilliant at parsing SMS, and it was just completely wrong for our user group. Just a little bit of research and a little bit of us being more open and looking probably could have saved ourselves quite a few months or years of development on that process. So it's easy to kind of just go down the wrong path if you're not kind of listening or don't have your eyes open.
Yeah, that's a great example. It's so funny how often I, as a developer, my hammer is often programming. And so suddenly every task becomes a programming problem.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I'll just make this quick assumption that they want to do everything by SMS. This means I get to write a lot of fun code to do natural language processing. This is going to be awesome. I'm going to go start right now.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that was probably our exact thought process. Unfortunately, it just wasn't required. I think it's a natural sort of tendency of people that work in the product team that they think that problems can be solved with code. And oftentimes they can.
Yep.
But oftentimes, no line of code needs to be written to solve the problem.
Totally.
And, you know, it's just that's our toolkit. So that's what we go and reach for. But actually, a lot of the times we make our best decisions when we like look for a different tool.
Totally. I feel like one of our best tricks as consultants is to just make sure we are frequently asking, do we really need to do this? And if we do really need to do this, do we really need to write code to do this?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Like just those two questions can save a lot of time and money.
Absolutely. You know, and then, you know, even when we come down to writing code, but like changing the code base, you know, we also look and just say like, okay, is it like the micro copy? Is it like, you know, the small amount of language on the page that's causing the confusion here? Do we really need a whole new feature? Or do we need to change what the submit button
right.
says? Like, you know, and
right.
it's, you know, sometimes it can be a very small change can like affect the overall change you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be hard sometimes to see that from the outset. In hindsight, it's always easier.
Right. Do you run user tests?
Yes. I mean, we're not as good as we'd like to be, which is kind of the stock answer to that, I guess.
right.
I think one of the things that we've done, and in some ways it's actually led to some of the best parts of our product, is that probably the most sophisticated part of our product is the admin backend piece, as we say, because they're the, you know, the power users are our customer service team, and they sit 20 feet away from us. So you've got this constant user testing sort of going on.
Mm-hmm.
But those users that are more invisible to you, the cleaners and the customers, because they're not like right there, I guess they always feel a little bit harder to access. But when we do user testing, you know, whether that's through, you know, surveys or bringing people in for focus groups or you know, just feedback sessions, the output is always like so useful, and every time we go, God, we really need to do that like sooner, and then and you know, a couple of months go by and we haven't, and we feel bad, and you know, we do it again. But we're, you know, right now we've got like an open role for kind of a user researcher that we're looking for precisely to make that a core part of our process, because we do believe in the output so much.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I feel like most product companies could use someone doing that all the time, basically.
Exactly. It just seems the kind of thing that like slips down the to-do list, you know, because it doesn't scream at you, you know, like the customer that's out there, you know, maybe you get some feedback emails coming through, but no one's going, hey, you haven't run a focus group in the last like 6 weeks.
Totally.
You know, it just doesn't happen. So you got to force
it. And it's a pain, right?
Yeah, I think like, it always feels a little bit hard, you know, because you can... If you try and make it like overly complex as an exercise, and then it just it starts getting out of control, you know, as to oh, we got to do this to make it meaningful. We'll need to like have this sample size, and what if we're polluting the data in this way or that way? And actually, it comes down to just go talk to some people, and you'd be surprised what you learn. The simpler you keep it, actually, the more useful it tends to be.
Sure, that's interesting. Well, that's good to know. You're still juggling schedules, which is the worst.
Absolutely, yeah. No, we're like the worst, you know, people for, like I say, every time we do it, we're like, oh, we got to do that again really soon. We got to make this a regular thing, and then it doesn't happen. But which is precisely why we want to get, you know, a person like whose sole job is to be doing this and constantly informing the product choices that we're making with the research that we've done and making sure that these sessions do happen on a much more regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a similar experience where I've yet to run a user test where I didn't kind of have my mind blown.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh my, no one sees this button. Like, we thought we made the button as big and bold as it could be, and no one even knows it's there.
Yeah. You know, you get those things where you're like, we thought this was great. And then, but there's always the other thing where it's like having your homework checked. And if you're seeing someone go through, you're like, oh yeah, we're going to fix that thing. Oh yeah, no. Oh, that page's not quite finished. Oh yeah, we want to do this, you know, and it, suddenly just even seeing somebody else looking at like the flows or like the screens, like just shows up all these things that you've kind of had in the back of your mind as to-dos, but like maybe never really articulated. So even just from that, before the user says a thing, you kind of your own self-critique kind of starts bringing stuff out that's quite useful to know. So they're super useful.
So now I want to take a second to thank the sponsors of this episode, who are DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. And I'm on their site right now, and this is a beautiful, beautiful marketing site. But I guess that's partly because it's beautiful and partly because the product is actually pretty solid. There's some really cool things that you can do on DigitalOcean, like private networking. So you can have your droplets, which are there, is their branded capital D word for servers. You can have droplets talk to each other in the same data center. If you're using that private network, the bandwidth between those servers does not count toward your bandwidth costs, which is kind of nice. You can replicate databases and do file storage and just various droplet-to-droplet communication. Droplet-to-droplet. Yeah, that's it. You can transfer a copy of your droplet snapshot to all regions. And they have a bunch of regions. There's Amsterdam and SF and New York and London, all that. You can move those snapshots around and then spin up the images in different data centers, which is nice if you have customers all over the globe, which you probably do because you're a badass. And all kinds of other great things like IP version 6 support, a nice API for making droplets, spin them up, spinning them down, evaporating them, boiling them, whatever you like to do to droplets. So head on over to digitalocean.com to learn more. And when you sign up, you can use code GIANTROBOTS with a giant G and R at checkout for a $10 credit towards your purchase. So thank you to DigitalOcean for supporting this show. So beyond your established things like the Kaizen Fridays, do you plan out your day or week in advance?
So we do like daily stand-ups. So we've got a Kaizen Kanban wall even up in the office, post-it notes special. So we put our work in progress limits on ourselves on each of the comms that we have. So cards go through from discovery through to wireframe, through to bill, through to like PR, then live. Mm-hmm. And then we have a post-deployment phase where we're, looking at the data that's coming back from the feature, and potentially we have some like snags or little, improvements that you want to do once they've gone live. Every morning the team, like, we have a stand up, we stand around the wall, we talk about the various things in progress. So in that way, we try and figure out what today's work is going to look like and what we're hoping to achieve. But, of course, there's always some things that come down the pipeline that have a hard deadline on them. And, I think the process always needs to adapt to, fit, what's needed of it. I think when you get too dogmatic about something, you tend to, not make it as effective as it could be.
Mm. Once you know what you're doing for the day, do you personally sit down and sketch out what it's going to look like, or do you could dive into work or something in between?
Yeah, I think like my particular role, I tend to have punctuated by meetings and we try and find like the effective moments in between those. But certainly for the rest of the team, we try our best to, make days productive so that, you're not constantly trying to like grab these 20 minutes of productive time and sandwich in between two meetings. So, we try not to have too many things on like at one time. So, whatever the designer or developers or even the PMs like working, one or two kind of cards like in progress in a day is probably enough, because you get that other kind of paralysis, right? If you've got like seven things you're meant to be working on right now, and suddenly an hour's gone past and you've actually not worked on anything. So, we try and keep that work in progress limit, pretty low, so that, you can kind of focus and you don't have that constant decision point as to what should I work on next.
So is that a limit per person, what they can have in progress?
Typically, like, it's not, so we're not super hard about it, but, it's rare that somebody has more than two things that they're meant to be working on right now. So, if they get blocked on one, they've always got the other thing to fall onto. But, we've definitely just found that when somebody has like four or five, six things that they're currently working on, there's just a lot of wheel spinning typically, and nothing seems to really move like through the board. So, in true Kanban style, like every day we're just trying to get the cards from left to right. That work in progress, limit shouldn't in and of itself be constraining. It just kind of helps to reduce that decision like paralysis.
So do you have more expansion planned right now?
Yeah, so we've actually kind of gone through an interesting phase in our company kind of saga. So we have joined forces with a German, formerly were a competitor, and now they're our friends and family. So we joined with a company called Helpline, who are based out of Berlin. So very similar concept. They'd started like last year, and they had expanded like really quickly internationally. In fact, they'd gone to Brazil and Australia and Canada, along with some other European cities. We ourselves had gone, from London through the rest of the UK into Ireland, France, and just starting to Germany. And we were kind of looking at this, we were at a fork in the road where we could, take on like our next round of funding and kind of duke it out with these guys city by city across Europe, or could we pull resources together and kind of, look more globally? And we chose the latter route. We like the idea of changing the narrative of having a European competitor kind of, being the global force rather than we're usually playing second fiddle. So it's quite nice. So we've kind of just gone through that process, and the two teams like starting to work together, although both platforms actually continue to exist separately. I'm now chief product officer across both platforms. So our expansion plans kind of have changed a little bit, but certainly we're looking at both, additional countries, and as we kind of talked about at the top of the segment, maybe different services as well. There's those two routes to how we can expand our footprint.
It seems that that's got to be a serious challenge to meld two companies together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always helped if, you know, your core vision is very similar. You know, we were amazingly, you got this thing when you're like talking about competitors and you're like, you know, you assume like all these like negative attributes on them. And then you meet the guys and you're like, oh, they're like really nice. And in fact, they're living in this like almost like parallel universe where, you know, they have all the same challenges and problems that we have. And they're looking at the market in such similar ways to us. And I think when you have those similarities at your core, it makes the whole process so much easier. And, you know, our ultimate goal was, you know, the same. So that definitely helps. But of course, you know, there's always those differences. The two platforms, while achieving a similar end result, are incredibly different. So I've kind of, you know, got that new added complexity of, you know, trying to manage prioritization across the two platforms and making sure that both are making strides in the right direction. And ultimately, the best practice from each, like, you know, we're kind of having that collaboration across them. So whatever learnings we make in each country is being shared.
Cool. So how come you don't write on the company blog?
I've got no excuse, really, apart from working like long days on the living.
Sure.
but yeah, we do need to up our writing abilities. Actually, we were just talking with the design team today. We were looking at and, you know, appraising MailChimp's blog. They had an awesome kind of creative.mailchimp, I think it is, like where the design team blog about a lot of things that they're working on. And the guys were kind of like drooling over that. So we thought our effort is pretty poor at the moment and we need to improve.
Yeah, I asked because this is one of my core interview tricks is to go read previous blog posts. So
yeah, one of the biggest spikes we ever had in our business. So back in was it February of 2013? Like we were just getting started on cleaning and we'd had our very first company night out. And we came in on the Friday morning feeling maybe a little bit worse for wear. We didn't think any good code was going to be written that day. So I wrote a blog post, which I called "The Shit TechCrunch Doesn't Tell You," which was sort of a blow-by-blow chronological account of the previous day and all the kind of crazy things that had happened. You know, that the non-glamorous stuff that like the buffed and sheened press releases on TechCrunch just never seemed to get to the heart of. Like we had this phone call from a cleaner who had got themselves lost in some customer's backyard and was now being chased by a dog. Because that's kind of like what my life had become. So we'd written this blog post and we must have hit Hacker News, I guess, at the right time because it went like up towards the top and we had like suddenly 10,000 visitors on our website, this website that had about like, you know, 20 concurrent visitors at any one point in time before. So we've seen the power of kind of blog posts and what can happen. But I think, you know, getting some consistency up there and some good content as well is always the key.
Hmm. So we're getting close to time. So I just have one more question. Do you have any skills or goals things you're trying to get better at over the next few months or years?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as a product team and myself as well, I think getting better at designing for mobile experience is something that we're trying to do more of. We're not proud of our mobile experience at the moment. I think we think there's a lot of work for us to do there. And I think, you know, for us, being able to conceive features and experiences that work well on a small handset and the, you know, kind of constriction that brings on what you can do, I certainly want to focus on. And I think, you know, just generally speaking in our product, we want to focus on and get better.
Makes sense. Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming over virtually and being on the podcast.
No, awesome. It's been fun.
So if people want to check out Hassle, they can go to hassle.com, right?
Absolutely. Hassle.com. Yeah, we're live in the UK and Ireland.
Excellent. Today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/161. Thanks for listening.